Babylon the Daughters, Chapter 18, Verses 1 to 3. And after these things I saw another angel come down from heaven, having great power, and the earth was lightened with his glory. And he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and is become the habitation of devils, and the hold of every foul spirit, and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. Some movement of mighty power is symbolized in these verses. See under verse 4. The consideration of a few facts will guide us unmistakably to the application. In chapter 14, we had a message announcing the fall of Babylon. Babylon is a term which embraces not only the Roman Catholic Church, but religious bodies which have sprung from her, bringing many of her errors and traditions along with them. A moral fall. The fall of Babylon here spoken of cannot be literal destruction. For there are events to take place in Babylon after her fall, which utterly forbid this idea. As for instance, the people of God are there after her fall, and are called out in order that they may not receive of her plagues. And in these plagues is embraced her literal destruction. The fall is therefore a moral one. For the result of it is that Babylon becomes the habitation of devils, and the hold of every foul spirit, and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. These are terrible descriptions of apostasy, showing that as a consequence of her fall, she piles up an accumulation of sins even to the heavens, and becomes subject to the judgments of God, which can no longer be delayed. And since the fall here introduced is a moral one, it must apply to some branch of Babylon besides or outside of the pagan or papal divisions. For from the beginning of their history, paganism has been a false religion, and the papacy an apostate one. And further, as this fall is said to occur but a short period before Babylon's final destruction, certainly this side of the rise and predicted triumph of the papal church, this testimony cannot apply to any religious organizations but such as have sprung from that church. These started out on reform. They ran well for a season and had the approbation of God. But fencing themselves about with creeds, they have failed to keep pace with the advancing light of prophetic truth, and hence have been left in a position where they will finally develop a character as evil and odious in the sight of God as that of the church from which they first withdrew as dissenters or reformers. As the point before us is to many a very sensitive one, we will let members of these various denominations here speak for themselves. Alexander Campbell says, "The worshiping establishments now in operation throughout Christendom, encased and cemented by their respective voluminous confessions of faith, and their ecclesiastical constitutions, are not churches of Jesus Christ, but the legitimate daughters of that mother of harlots, the Church of Rome." Again, he says, a reformation of popery was attempted in Europe full 3 centuries ago. It ended in a Protestant hierarchy and swarms of dissenters. Protestantism has been reformed into Presbyterianism, that into Congregationalism, and that into Baptistism, etc., etc. Methodism has attempted to reform all, but has reformed itself into many forms of Wesleyanism. All of them retain in their bosom, in their ecclesiastical organizations, worship, doctrines, and observances, various relics of popery. They are at best a reformation of popery, and only reformations in part. The doctrines and traditions of men yet impair the power and the progress of the gospel in their hands. On Baptism, page 15. The report of the Michigan Yearly Conference, published in the True Wesleyan on November 15, 1851, says, "The world, commercial, political, and ecclesiastical, are alike, and are together going in the broad way that leads to death. Politics, commerce, and nominal religion all connive at sin, reciprocally aid each other, and unite to crush the poor. Falsehood is unblushingly uttered in the forum and in the pulpit, and sins that would shock the moral sensibilities of the heathen go unrebuked in all the great denominations of our land. These churches are like the Jewish church when the Savior exclaimed, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites!" Is their condition any better now than it was then? Abundance of similar testimony might be produced from persons in high standing in these various denominations, written not for the purpose of being captious and finding fault, but from a vivid sense of the fearful condition to which these churches have fallen. The term Babylon, as applied to them, is not a term of reproach, but is simply expressive of the confusion and diversity of sentiment that exists among them. Babylon need not have fallen, but might have been healed, Jeremiah chapter 51, verse 9, by the reception of the truth, but she rejected it, and confusion and dissension still reign within her borders, and worldliness and pride are fast choking out every plant of heavenly growth. Chronology of this movement. At what time do these verses have their application? When may this movement be looked for? If the position here taken is correct, that these churches, this branch of Babylon, experienced a moral fall by the rejection of the first message of chapter 14, the announcement in the chapter under consideration could not have gone forth previous to that time. It is then either synchronous with the message of the fall of Babylon in chapter 14, or it is given at a later period than that. But it cannot be synonymous with that. For that merely announces the fall of Babylon, while this adds several particulars which at that time were neither fulfilled nor in process of fulfillment. As we are therefore to look this side of 1844, where the previous message went forth for the announcement brought to view in this chapter, we inquire, has any such message been given from that time to the present? The answer must still be in the negative. Hence, this message is yet future. But we are now having the third angel's message, which is the last to be given before the coming of the Son of Man. We are therefore held to the conclusion that the first two verses of this chapter constitute a feature of the third message, which is to appear when this message shall be proclaimed with power, and the whole earth be lightened with its glory. The work brought to view in verse 2 is in process of accomplishment, and will soon be completed by the work of spiritualism. What are called in Revelation chapter 16, verse 14, spirits of devils working miracles, are secretly but rapidly working their way into the religious denominations above referred to, for their creeds have been formulated under the influence of the wine, or errors of Babylon, one of which is that spirits of our dead friends, conscious, intelligent, and active, are all about us, and this renders such denominations unable to resist the approach of evil spirits who come to them under the names and impersonations of their dead friends. A significant feature in the work of spiritualism just now is the religious garb it is assuming, keeping in the background its grosser principles, which it has heretofore carried so largely in the front. It now assumes to appear as respectably religious in some quarters, as any other denomination in the land. It talks of sin, repentance, the atonement, salvation through Christ, etc., almost as orthodoxly as the most approved standards. Under the guise of this profession, what is to hinder it from entrenching itself in almost every denomination in Christendom? The basis of spiritualism is a fundamental dogma in the creeds of almost all the churches. Its secret principles are, alas, too commonly cherished, and its dark practices too commonly followed, to put them at variance on that ground, so long as they seek a common concealment. What then can save Christendom from its seductive influence? Herein is seen another sad result of rejecting the truths offered to the world by the messages of chapter 14. Had the churches received these messages, they would have been shielded against this delusion. For among the great truths developed by the religious movement there brought to view is the important doctrine that the soul of man is not naturally immortal, that eternal life is a gift suspended on conditions and to be acquired through Christ alone, that the dead are unconscious, and that the rewards and punishments of the future world lay beyond the resurrection and the day of judgment. This strikes a death blow to the first and vital claim of spiritualism. What foothold can that doctrine secure in any mind fortified by this truth? The spirit comes and claims to be the disembodied soul or spirit of a dead man. It is met with the fact that this is not the kind of soul or spirit which man possesses, that the dead know not anything, that this, its first pretension, is a lie, and that the credentials it offers show it to belong to the synagogue of Satan. Thus it is at once rejected, and the evil it would do is effectually prevented. But the great mass of religionists stand opposed to the truth which would thus shield them, and thereby expose themselves to this last manifestation of satanic cunning. And while spiritualism is thus working, startling changes are manifesting themselves in high places in some of the denominations. The infidelity of the present age, under the seductive names of science, the higher criticism, evolution, etc., is making not a few notable converts. Public attention was forcibly called to this situation by a writer, Mr. Harold Bowley, in the Cosmopolitan Magazine for May 1909. Having made an investigation into the character of the teaching that was being imparted in some of the leading universities of this country, he reported the results in the Cosmopolitan, which drew forth this comment from the editor. What Mr. Bolsey sets down here is of the most astounding character. Out of the curricula of American colleges, a dynamic movement is upheaving ancient foundations and promising a way for revolutionary thought and life. Those who are not in close touch with the great colleges of the country will be astonished to learn the creeds being fostered by the faculties of our great universities. In hundreds of classrooms it is being taught daily that the Decalogue is no more sacred than a syllabus, that the home as an institution is doomed, that there are no absolute evils, that immortality is simply an act in contravention of society's accepted standards. These are some of the revolutionary and sensational teachings submitted with academic warrant to the minds of hundreds of thousands of students in the United States. At about the same time, the Independent New York, an exponent of the higher criticism, referred to conditions in the Baptist and Presbyterian churches with the announcement that the heretics have won the day in Chicago and New York. This was shown by the action of their ministers' meetings in those cities in refusing to exclude from the ministry teachers of the most open heresies. It has been a bad week for the old guard, said the Independent, and these occurrences give evidences of a mighty change of view on questions of theology within the past 20 years, or even 10. Continuing, the same journal said, "The mighty breath of tolerance which these Baptist and Presbyterian bodies thus allow is hardly less than revolutionary. It began with the scientific and historical study of the Bible, when we found that the world was more than 6,000 years old, that there was no universal flood 4,000 years ago, that Adam was not made directly from dust, and Eve from his rib, and that the Tower of Babel was not the occasion of the diversification of languages. We had gone too far to stop. The process of criticism had to go on from Genesis to Revelation, with no fear of the curse at the end of the last chapter. It could not stop with Moses and Isaiah. It had to include Matthew and John and Paul. Every one of them had to be sifted. They had already ceased to be taken as unquestioned final authorities. For plenary inspiration had followed verbal inspiration, just as soon as the first chapter of Genesis had ceased to be taken as true history. The miracles of Jesus had to be tested as well as those of Elijah. The date and purpose of the Gospel of John had to be investigated historically, as well as that of the prophecy of Isaiah, and the conclusion of historical criticism had to be accepted with no regard to the old theologies. We have just reached this condition, and there is repeated evidence that it marks an epoch, a revolution in theological thought. This is what we learn from Chicago and New York, from two such militant denominations as the Baptist and the Presbyterian. From the standpoint of such a lamentable outlook, and under the leadership of such men, how long before Babylon will become full of spirits that are foul, and birds that are hateful and unclean? What progress has already been made in this direction? How would the godly fathers and mothers of the generation that lived just before the first message was given, could they rise from their graves and comprehend the present condition of the religious world, hearing its teaching and beholding its practices, stand aghast at the fearful contrast between their time and ours, and deplore the sad degeneracy? And heaven is not to let all this pass in silence, for a mighty proclamation is to be made, calling the attention of all the world to the fearful counts in the indictment against these unfaithful religious bodies, that the justice of the judgments that follow may plainly appear. Verse 3 shows the wide extent of the influence of Babylon and the evil that has resulted and will result from her course, and hence the justness of her punishment. The merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. Who take the lead in all the extravagances of the age? Who load their tables with the richest and choicest viands? Who are foremost in extravagance in dress and all costly attire? Who are the very personification of pride and arrogance? Are they not church members? Where shall we look for the highest exhibition of the luxury, vain show, and pride of life, resulting from the vanity and sin of the race? Is it not to a modern church assembly on a pleasant Sunday? But there is a redeeming feature in this picture. Degenerate as Babylon has become as a body, there are exceptions to the general rule. For God has still a people there, and she must be entitled to some regard on their account, until they are called from her communion. Nor will it be necessary to wait long for this call. Soon Babylon will become so thoroughly leavened with the influence of these evil agents that her condition will be fully manifest to all the honest in heart, and the way will be all prepared for the work which the apostle now introduces. Verses 4 to 8. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Reward her even as she rewarded you, and double unto her double according to her works. In the cup which she hath filled, fill to her double. How much she hath glorified herself, and lived deliciously, so much torment and sorrow give her. For she saith in her heart, I sit a queen, and am no widow, and shall see no sorrow. Therefore shall her plagues come in one day, death and mourning and famine. And she shall be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judgeth her. The voice coming from heaven denotes that it will be a message of power, attended with heavenly glory. How marked becomes the interposition of heaven, and how the agents for the accomplishment of God's work multiply, as the great crisis approaches. This voice from heaven is called another voice, showing that a new agency is here introduced. We now have five celestial messengers expressly mentioned as engaged in this last religious reformation. These are the first, second, and third angels of chapter 14. Fourth, the angel of verse 1 of this chapter. And fifth, the agency indicated by the voice of verse 4 now before us. Three of these are already in operation. The second angel has joined the first, and the third has joined them. The first and second angel have not ceased. All three now have the field. The angel of verse 1 is entering upon his mission, as the conditions which call for his work are supplied. And the divine call from heaven must take place in connection with his work. Proof has already been offered to show that the message of verses 1 and 2 of this chapter is to be given in connection with the now current third message, and will mark a new era in this work. An idea of its extent and power may be gathered from the description of the angel there given. The first message is said to go with a loud voice. The same is also said of the third message. But this angel, instead of simply flying in the midst of heaven like the others, is said to come down from heaven. He comes, as it were, nearer to the earth, with a message more pointed and direct. And he has great power, and the earth is lightened with his glory. No such description of a message from heaven to man is elsewhere to be found in all the Bible. This is the last, and as is meet, it comes with surpassing glory and unwonted power. It is an awful hour when a world's destiny is to be decided, a most solemn crisis when an entire contemporaneous generation of the human family is to pass the bounds of probation. As the last note of mercy is sounded in their ears, in such a time the world must not be left without warning. So amply must the great fact be heralded that none can plead a reasonable ignorance of the impending doom. Every excuse must be taken away. The justice and long-suffering and forbearance of God in delaying threatened vengeance till all have had an opportunity to receive a knowledge of his will and space to repent must be vindicated. An angel is sent forth, panoplied with heaven's power. The light that encircles the throne enshrouds him. He comes to the earth. None but the spiritually dead, yea, twice dead and plucked up by the roots, would fail to realize his presence. Light flashes everywhere. The dark places are lighted up. And while his presence dispels the shadows, his voice in thundertones utters a warning. He cries mightily. He speaks in no feeble tones and with no uncertain sound. It is no parlor announcement, but a cry, a mighty cry, a cry with a strong voice. The fatal defects in the profession of a worldly church are again pointed out. Their errors are once more and for the last time exposed. The inadequacy of the present standard of godliness to meet the final crisis is emphasized beyond all mistaking. The inevitable connection between their cherished errors and irretrievable and everlasting destruction is heralded till the earth resounds with the cry. Meanwhile, great Babylon's sins mount up to the heavens, and the remembrance of her iniquities comes up before God. The storm of vengeance gathers. The great tidal wave of supernal wrath rolls onward. The feathery foam plays along its crest, indicating that but an instant remains ere it will burst upon the great city of confusion, and proud Babylon will go down as a millstone sinks in the depths of the sea. Suddenly another voice rings out from heaven. Come out of her, my people. The humble, sincere, devoted children of God, of whom there are some still left, and who sigh and cry over the abominations done in the land, heed the voice, wash their hands of her sins, separate from her communion, escape and are saved, while Babylon becomes the victim of the just judgments of God. There are stirring times before the church. Let us be ready for the crisis. The fact that God's people are called out so as not to be partakers of her sins shows that it is not till a certain time that people become guilty by being connected with Babylon. And this explains how it can be said of the 144,000, Revelation chapter 14, verse 4, many of whom are the very ones here called out, that they were not defiled with women. Verses 6 and 7 are a prophetic declaration that she will be rewarded or punished according to her works. Bear in mind that this testimony applies to that portion of Babylon which is subject to a moral fall. As already pointed out, it must apply especially to the daughters, the denominations who persist in clinging to the personal traits of the mother and keep up the family resemblance. These, as pointed out on a previous page, are to attempt a sweeping persecution against the truth and the people of God. By these, the image of the beast is to be formed. These are to have what will be to them a new experience, the use of the civil arm to enforce their dogmas. And it is doubtless this first intoxication of power that leads this branch of Babylon to cherish in her heart the boast, "I sit a queen and am no widow." That is, I am no longer one bereaved or destitute of power as I have been. But now I rule like a queen. I shall see no sorrow. God is in the constitution, the church is enthroned, and shall henceforth bear sway. The expression, "reward her even as she rewarded you," seems to show that the time for this message to be given, and for the saints to be called out, will be when she begins to raise against them the arm of oppression. As she fills up the cup of persecution to the saints, so the angel of the Lord will persecute her, Psalm 35:6, and judgments from on high will bring upon her, in a twofold degree, the evil which she thought to bring upon the humble servants of the Lord. On page 137 of Spiritual Gifts, as found in early writings by Mrs. E.G. White, we find testimony showing that the first part of Revelation chapter 18 has special reference to the religious oppression to be developed in the United States by professed Christians. Thus, it will be more tolerable for the heathen and for papists in the day of the execution of God's judgment than for such men. The names of the oppressors are written in blood, crossed with stripes and flooded with agonizing, burning tears of suffering. God's anger will not cease until he has caused this land of light to drink to the dregs of the cup of his fury, until he has rewarded unto Babylon double. Reward her even as she rewarded you, and double unto her double according to her works. In the cup which she hath filled, fill to her double. The day in which her plagues come, mentioned in verse 8, must be a prophetic day, or at least cannot be a literal day, for it would be impossible for famine to come in that length of time. The plagues of Babylon are without doubt the seven last plagues, which have already been examined, and the plain inference from the language of this verse, in connection with Isaiah chapter 34, verse 8, is that a year will be occupied in that terrible visitation. Verses 9 to 11. And the kings of the earth who have committed fornication and live deliciously with her shall bewail her and lament for her when they shall see the smoke of her burning, standing afar off from the fear of her torment, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city, Babylon, that mighty city! For in 1 hour is thy judgment come." And the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buyeth their merchandise any more. A fitting retribution. The infliction of the very first plague must result in a complete suspension of traffic in those articles of luxury for which Babylon is noted. And when the merchants of these things, who are to a great extent citizens of this symbolic city, and who have been made rich by their traffic in these things, suddenly find themselves and their neighbors smitten with putrefying sores, their traffic suspended, and vast stores of merchandise on hand, but none to buy them. They lift up their voices in lamentation for the fate of this great city. For if there is anything which will draw from the men of this generation a sincere cry of distress, it is that which touches their treasures. And there is a fitness in this retribution. They who but a short time before had issued a decree that the saints of God should neither buy nor sell, now find themselves put under the same restriction by a far more effectual process. The question may arise how persons involved in the same calamity can stand afar off and lament, etc. But it must be remembered that this desolation is brought to view under a figure, and the figure is that of a city visited with destruction. Should calamity come upon a literal city, it would be natural for its inhabitants to flee from that city if they had opportunity, and standing afar off lament its fall. And just in proportion to their terror and amazement at the evil impending would be the distance at which they would stand from their devoted city. Now the figure the apostle uses would not be complete without a feature of this kind, and so he uses it not to imply that people would literally flee from the symbolic city, which would be impossible, but to denote their terror and amazement at the descending judgments. Verses 12 and 13. The merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and of pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and all thyan wood and all manner vessels of ivory and all manner vessels of the most precious wood and of brass and iron and marble and cinnamon and odors and ointments and frankincense and wine and oil and fine flour and wheat, and beasts, and sheep, and horses, and chariots, and slaves, and souls of men. Babylon's merchandise. In these verses we have an enumeration of great Babylon's merchandise, which includes everything pertaining to luxurious living, pomp, and worldly display. All kinds of mercantile traffic are brought to view. The declaration concerning slaves and souls of men may pertain more particularly to the spiritual domain, and have reference to slavery of conscience by the creeds of these bodies, which in some cases is more oppressive than physical bondage. Verse 14. And the fruits that thy soul lusted after are departed from thee, and all things which were dainty and goodly are departed from thee, and thou shalt find them no more at all. Gluttony rebuked. The fruits here mentioned are according to the original autumnal fruits, and in this we find a prophecy that the delicacies of the season, upon which the luxurious gourmand so sets his pampered appetite, will be suddenly cut off. This, of course, is the work of the famine, which is the result of the fourth vial, chapter 16, verse 8, and we may be, even now, having a premonition of this destruction. In the phylloxera of the vineyards, the scales and moths, and other recent enemies to vegetation. In this connection, we can hardly forbear glancing at the general aspect of the times in respect to the remarkable physical phenomena everywhere manifesting themselves, as they seem so plainly to indicate that all the courses of nature are disturbed, and that the earth itself is waxing old in anticipation of the time when it shall vanish away. Within a few years past, how many unnatural visitations of earthquake and fire, storm and flood, have wrought ruin in different localities, and awakened forebodings of fear in the hearts of men in general. Witness the Chicago fire, the Baltimore fire, the Toronto fire, and the destruction by earthquake and fire of San Francisco, Valparaiso, and Kingston, the floods of the Ohio, the Mississippi, and other western rivers, the devastating floods of Europe, the famines of China and Russia, and the plague in India, the cyclones and tidal waves sweeping away the proudest works of man, and hurling thousands of human beings into untimely graves. Verses 15 to 19. The merchants of these things which were made rich by her shall stand afar off for the fear of her torment, weeping and wailing, and saying, "Alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen and scarlet and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls. For in 1 hour so great riches is come to naught, and every shipmaster and all the company in ships and sailors and as many as trade by sea stood afar off and cried when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, What city is like unto this great city? And they cast dust on their heads, and cried, weeping and wailing, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city, wherein were made rich all that had ships in the sea, by reason of her costliness, for in 1 hour is she made desolate." Emotions of the wicked. The reader can readily imagine the cause of this universal voice of mourning, lamentation, and woe. Imagine the plague of sores preying upon men, the rivers turned to blood, the sea like the blood of a dead man, the sun scorching men with fire, their traffic gone, and their silver and gold unable to deliver them. And we need not wonder at their exclamation of distress, nor that shipmasters and sailors join in the general wail. Very different is the emotion the saints are called upon to exercise, as the following testimony shows. Verses 20 to 24. "Rejoice over her, thou heaven, and ye holy apostles and prophets, for God hath avenged you on her. And a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone, and cast it into the sea, saying, Thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down, and shall be found no more at all. And the voice of harpers and musicians, and of pipers and trumpeters, shall be heard no more at all in thee. And no craftsman of whatever craft he be shall be found any more in thee. And the sound of a millstone shall be heard no more at all in thee. And the light of a candle shall shine no more at all in thee. And the voice of the bridegroom and of the bride shall be heard no more at all in thee. For thy merchants were the great men of the earth, for by thy sorceries were all nations deceived. And in her was found the blood of prophets, and of saints, and of all that were slain upon the earth." Emotions of the righteous. The apostles and prophets are here called upon to rejoice over great Babylon in her destruction, as it is in close connection with this destruction that they will all be delivered from the power of death and the grave by the first resurrection. Like a great millstone, Babylon sinks to rise no more. The various arts and crafts that have been employed in her midst and have ministered to her desires shall be practiced no more. The pompous music that has been employed in her imposing but formal and lifeless service dies away forever. The scenes of festivity and gladness, when the bridegroom and the bride have been led before her altars, shall be witnessed no more. Her sorceries constitute her leading crime, and sorcery is a practice which is involved in the spiritualism of today. And in her was found the blood of all that were slain upon the earth. From this, it is evident that ever since the introduction of a false religion into the world, Babylon has existed. In her has been found all along opposition to the work of God and persecution of his people. In reference to the guilt of the last generation, see on chapter 16, verse 6.